Once a term is coined, it tends to get used, like the term midlife crisis. It's not that old, but boy, does it have some weight in our society. Think of all the images the term midlife crisis conjures up, like the cliche of buying a red sports car to feel young and free again. We'll skip the sports car in this hour and opt instead for a bus ride with Aristotle and John Stuart Mill and Schopenhauer and other philosophers and thinkers. Our guest, Kiran Satya, brings them together for a book called Midlife, A Philosophical Guide. Kiran Satya lives in the Boston area and is a professor of philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, better known as MIT. He has written two previous books on philosophy and its applications in modern life. Kiran, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you very much for having me.
So did the subject of the book come naturally to you as you aged?
Yeah, very naturally. Too naturally, yes. It definitely came out of my own experience. I think academia is especially well-suited to generate this sense of having worked incredibly hard, jumped through the hoops, and in some sense made it, but realizing as you sort of reach a kind of mid-career point that you don't really know what to do next. And it was at that point that I thought I would turn my problem against itself by using my midlife crisis to think about philosophy in the midlife crisis.
Did you change jobs in as part of this, didn't you?
I did move jobs, yeah. I mean, I think I moved from the University of Pittsburgh to MIT. I was already sort of thinking about the midlife crisis when I was at Pitt, and I'm not sure how much the job change corresponded to the crisis, but definitely the shift from writing academic books for colleagues to trying to write something for a wider audience was definitely part of the desire to find something new to do and to change my relationship to philosophy.
But while the book is a focus on midlife, I'm glad you also point out that crises about life and where we're going with it do not have to be just in the middle.
No, that's definitely true. So, people, when I was describing to friends my midlife crisis, people would sometimes make fun of me and say, you know, it sounds like you're going through what I went through when I was a teenager. What, you know, it was an arrested development. But yeah, I think a lot of the problems that people associate with midlife crisis that do tend to come into focus around midlife really just have to do with the sort of temporal structure of human life and really with the irreversibility of time, the fact that you accumulate a past that you cannot change and have to come to terms with, that your options narrow, that death becomes closer, and that the grind of life becomes more all-consuming. And those are all quite pervasive features of life that people can reflect on earlier or later.
Sure. But the sense that gets particularly acute in middle age, like, you know, where have I come from, where am I going to, and what am I doing right now, gets acute, it seems like, when you're standing right in the middle of the road.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, for instance, it's the point in life where often you realize that the childhood dreams that you'd sort of secretly continued to harbor, you're really not going to do those things. That you might take up piano as a hobby, but you're never going to be the pianist you sort of imagined you would be or could have been earlier. Or it's the point in life when you realize that things you've made real mistakes. There are things that you've done that are regrets that really shape your life and you now have to come to terms with. And those kinds of things, I think, tend to be especially salient around midlife. Also because it's a point at which the sort of upward slope, if you've been striving to get a job, to get married, have kids, you've either done those things or you haven't. And so it is a kind of time to take stock of life.
And to look for new accomplishments, perhaps. It's no surprise that you, a philosopher, would choose to look into philosophy for clues about how to approach and deal with midlife. I must admit, though, Kiran, it sounds like a dare when you say try reading Kant or Aristotle.
Yes. No, I mean, actually, one thing I think about philosophy is that a lot of philosophy is relatively difficult, relatively intractable, relatively inaccessible. And so what I wanted to, even though I think there are insights and ideas in philosophy that really can inform people's lives, that can operate as a kind of cognitive therapy, a kind of self-help in changing how you think about your life. So I wanted to find a way to write about ideas that can get esoteric, accessibly, and in a sort of lively way that actually connects them with the kind of problems that people, that my friends, for instance, were struggling with in their lives and are struggling with in their lives. But yeah, that's sort of the challenge of writing philosophy for a wider audience is to write about these ideas that can get quite intricate in a way that doesn't dumb them down at all.
But, you know, you give us a good backing off point, those of us who don't read philosophy as a general thing, and you say that the general strains of philosophy can be stated fairly simply, but if you opt to go into further detail and study, there's plenty there.
No, that's right. So my treatment of these issues sort of scratches the surface in a way. There's a lot more that one could pursue, and I sort of end the book with suggested readings and things you could follow up on if you wanted to read more about the issues about sort of regret and missing out and death that the book attempts to tackle. But I do think that there are philosophical ideas that are that it is possible to express non-technically. And that it's worth doing that because some of those ideas are genuinely helpful, and they've been helpful to me.
So while you have compiled Midlife, A Philosopher's Guide to Address Midlife, you also do say that the trials of middle age have been neglected by philosophers. Are they fairly silent about this, or just talk about more life more generally?
I think there is a tendency for philosophers reflecting on ethical questions about how to live to adopt either a sort of pragmatic perspective, you know, what do I have to do? What are my reasons for action? What are my obligations to other people? Which is a sort of in-the-moment, forward-looking question. Or to ask the way Plato and Aristotle did, for instance, what's a good human life? Which sort of adopts a perspective from outside of life and asks what a whole life should look like. And those ways of thinking do tend to neglect the sort of in-the-middle position of someone in midlife, where you're not looking at your whole life. You have a substantial past that you have to now deal with. But your question is not just forward-looking. It's about how to feel about the past and your identity and where you are.
All kinds of great stuff from a whole bunch of different philosophers and other writers as well. The book is called Midlife, A Philosophical Guide. Kieran Satya at MIT is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Put your own mind to thinking about midlife and some of the things that helped you along the way. And you can join the discussion with us on the Exchange when we come back in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. When confronted with the challenges of midlife, do you choose the red sports car or John Stuart Mill? Kieran Satya, well, we haven't asked about the sports car, but he chose John Stuart Mill and several other philosophers. He is a philosopher himself, a professor of philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. He's written a book called Midlife, A Philosophical Guide, in which he plumbs philosophy and all of its thinkers for clues about how to look at midlife. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, to swap some stories about midlife and how you approach it and what philosophies work for you. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Kieran, you're not the first person, in fact, not even the first person on this program to bring philosophy into the self-help realm. Is it generally a pretty good fit, do you find?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think it's in fact, it's sort of interesting how little contemporary philosophers tend to write self-help, given that in the history of philosophy, I think the idea that there was a separation between the two is a relative novelty. I mean, I think the idea that philosophical reflection about life should make life better was central to the philosophical tradition until around sort of the 18th century. So I think when philosophers now go back to writing or trying to write self-help, they're sort of returning to a traditional ambition of philosophy, an aspiration of philosophy. And I think because that aspiration has been somewhat neglected, there's a lot in contemporary philosophy that can be helpful that just hasn't really been mined that way, that people haven't philosophers haven't used that way.
Well, were they trying to be removed a little bit, or is it just a matter of, you know, this is a philosophy, you have to like come to it on your own terms?
I think there's something to the thought that philosophy is a sort of search for the truth, should not we shouldn't assume at the outset that it's going to be therapeutically valuable. So when we're starting to inquire into midlife, and I suppose this was my position, I was open-minded at the beginning whether philosophy would be consoling or whether the results of thinking philosophically about the problems about regret and so on that I was feeling would be just even more demoralizing than I had started out. So I think there is a sense that philosophy should be open inquiry, it should be open to anything. In this case, I think it turns out that what philosophy suggests about missing out and regret and death and so on can be therapeutic. But yeah, I think that the idea of philosophy as a quest for truth that just may or may not be consoling makes a lot of philosophers reluctant treat philosophy as self-help. I think there's also a kind of anxiety about sort of seeming like a guru and not wanting people to think for themselves that probably makes philosophers wary of taking on a certain kind of self-help identity.
Tell me more, master, that sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah. Yeah, you tried to write a book, you say, that can be read while standing on one foot, which is, but that bears some unpacking. What's that a reference to?
Well, it's a wonderful story about two rabbis, sort of roughly contemporaneous with the time of Jesus, Hillel and Shammai. And the story is that a Gentile comes to Shammai, who's the strict one, and says, I'll convert to Judaism if you teach me the Torah while standing on one foot. And Shammai says, this is ridiculous, forget about it. And he goes to Hillel, and Rabbi Hillel says, do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. That is the whole Torah. All the rest is commentary. Now go study. And there's this suggestion that it's worth trying to capture even complicated ideas with simplicity, even if, of course, there's a risk that you're going to be accused of being naive or simplifying. And I think that might be another reason why some philosophers are wary of writing philosophy in this way, is that it will be open to criticism by their professional colleagues, who will have all kinds of objections about the subtleties. But I think it's a mistake for philosophers to let that sort of inhibit them from writing for a general audience.
So here again, you can take the concept simply and delve in as deeply as you'd like. The history of the term midlife crisis, what does that date back to?
Well, interestingly, unlike most sort of cliches, which sort of fade into the murky past, it has a definite date of origin, which is 1965. This Canadian psychoanalyst, Elliot Jacques, published an essay, Death and the Midlife Crisis, in which he describes his sort of middle-aged, by he meant sort of late 30s, patients, experiencing this sense of having reached the crest of the hill and looking down at the second half of life, pointing towards death. And that's where the phrase comes from, and it really took off from there. I mean, I think the idea really caught people's imagination, so that by the 1970s, it was already becoming a kind of cultural cliche.
Well, now we have the cliche of the red sports car and the trophy wife and all the other things that come with that. And we're not making any recommendations here. I want to make that clear. Kiran Sethi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a philosopher at MIT. His book is Midlife, A Philosophical Guide. I want to talk about the U-shaped curve of well-being, because this sounds like a fairly universal thing.
Yeah, this is an interesting feature of recent social science studying midlife, is that so the initial stereotype was very much gendered, and it seemed very much like it was a problem of the affluent. In the last 10 years or so, economists who work on well-being, David Blanchflower, Andrew Oswald in particular, have done a lot of studies all around the world of people's reported life satisfaction at different ages. And what they find in sort of more than 70 countries around the world is that life satisfaction takes the shape of a gently curving U. So it starts high in youth, that the peak is around 20. It bottoms out in your 40s, and then it actually ends even higher in older age. So it looks as though midlife is a time of genuine struggle or hardship, even if it's not a kind of intense crisis, but a time of relative difficulty for people all around the world. And although people say that the curve of the U is relatively gentle, the drop in life satisfaction between the sort of age 20 point and the average age 45 point is like the drop in life satisfaction you would associate with losing your job or getting a divorce. So there's a genuine dip in people's satisfaction with their lives in middle age.
And is that something that is not just a United States thing? It's seen in many countries?
Yeah, so it shows up all around the world. It does show up a little less in the developing than the developed world, but it still shows up. So it suggests that there's something quite pervasively going on. I mean, we obviously can't know really on the basis of this kind of social science how far into the past this projects. Like, if we'd done these studies 100 years ago, what they would have looked like. But it doesn't seem specific to the U.S. or the developed West. It seems like a global phenomenon.
All right, the U-shaped curve, and obviously the bottom of the curve is the middle of life. So let's get started in talking about the philosophers that you have turned to for some advice or some thoughts about how to work with midlife. John Stuart Mill is featured prominently. Why him?
Well, Mill was really an inspiration to me. He had a nervous breakdown. It came very early. He was 20, but his entire life was sort of accelerated. So his father educated him in this intense way where he learned Greek at 3 and Latin at 7, basically did his university education, or the equivalent, in his teenage years. So then he has his midlife crisis when he's about 20. The thing that's wonderful about Mill for me is that, unlike many philosophers, he then writes a memoir. He writes his autobiography. And in the autobiography, he's trying to figure out what went wrong with his life. And so it's the rare case of a philosopher in the sort of Western tradition really philosophically scrutinizing his own life crisis. So that's one reason why he was really important to me. But the other part of what's interesting about Mill's crisis is that it's puzzling. So it begins with him saying he was devoting his life to social reform, to relieving suffering, to making people's lives better. And he realizes, with a sense of sort of emptiness, that if he achieved that, he wouldn't know what to do, and it wouldn't, in fact, make him happy. And the puzzle is, how could achieving what you really want, which you think is worth doing, leave you with a sense of futility or emptiness? And I think part of the answer to that is that he was very much focused on what I call ameliorative values, so the value of making things less bad than they would otherwise be, solving problems or answering needs. And what he realized in his, you know, quarter-life crisis was that there's another kind of value that he was neglecting, which is the value of things in life that don't just answer needs. For him, it was reading Wordsworth's poetry, something that's not solving a problem, but has a kind of value in itself. And I think that kind of distinction in value is quite useful for people in the middle of life, even if they're not like Mill. I think there's a way in which middle age can involve feeling the kind of sandwich pressure of what needs to be done to take care of your family, with work, with your parents, and a sense that your whole life is devoted to things that are valuable and worthwhile, but it's all about sort of solving problems, never about things that are positively good. And I think that's the need to find space in life for things that are positively good is something we can really take from Mill.
I am struck by two things that come up again and again here in the book. And number one is the idea that you should try to be happy. And this is specific to John Stuart Mill, but that itself is not a goal. So that's one. And the other one is the sense of like no more worlds to conquer. I come back to Alexander the Great for this, who's not in the book, by the way. The idea that once he accomplished all these things, it's like, well, now what do I do? So let's take those in turn. First, the idea that from John Stuart Mill that happiness is not really a goal in itself.
Yeah, I mean, this is an idea that goes back in philosophy, at least to Joseph Butler, an Anglican bishop writing in the 18th century. It gets called the paradox of egoism, and the argument is that if you aim too exclusively at your own happiness, if that's what you're obsessed with, you'll lack the kind of investment in things outside yourself that actually brings happiness. You'll sort of impede your own opportunities to be happy. And so I think there's a kind of puzzle here at the heart of the whole idea of self-help, the whole genre, which is that being excessively focused on your own happiness can prevent you from finding sources of happiness. So one of the things that Mill suggests that I think is right is that finding new things to care about, finding new investments, which might be a hobby or it might be working in a soup kitchen or it might be volunteering or finding new things to do outside of yourself that you really care about, is one of the ways in which happiness can become more available and more accessible. And in fact, not thinking too much about your own happiness is important. So there's a way in which when you're reading self-help, it's kind of a ladder you have to throw away. You're thinking about how to be happy at this point, but in the long run, the idea will be to be thinking less about what's going to make me happy and more about the investments outside yourself that actually are making you happy.
Now, what about the other idea that we've accomplished what we set out to do, and now it's like, well, now what do we do? Because, you know, we're in the middle, and we did all those things. We got married, we had kids, we achieved professional success, those sorts of things.
Yeah, for me, this was a very big part of sort of the midlife crisis, was the sense that I'd sort of built my life around completable projects, around ambitions that I wanted to achieve, and at a certain point, I'd sort of achieved some of them. I'd got a job in philosophy, and I was a professor, and I didn't have a plan exactly. I didn't have a picture of what I was going to do next in life. And my sense about what's going on there is the solution is not so much to find some new plans. It's because there's a kind of a problem that's inherent in the whole nature of a kind of plan-obsessed, plan-directed, type A sort of goal-focused life, which is that if you're building your life around projects like get married, get a promotion at work, have a kid, you're building your life around activities where satisfaction is always in the future, and as soon as you've achieved it, it's sort of archived in the past. And your engagement with those activities has this perverse feature of sort of ending them, of taking these meaningful things and just kicking them out of your life. And it's important to see that not all activities are like that. So in the book, I talk about the contrast between telic activities that comes from the Greek word telos, or purpose. So those are the ones that have terminal states they aim at, endpoints or goals. And activities like parenting or spending time with your friends or thinking about philosophy or listening to music, they don't aim at some point of completion at which you're sort of done with them. Those are what I call atelic activities. And I think one kind of way to fill this, the sense of what next, what are my next projects, the sense of emptiness in the pursuit of projects, is to value more fully and find meaning in atelic activities where you're not deferring something to the future, you're not finishing it and completing it and sending it into the past. If you want to be sort of spending time with your friends, and you're spending time with your friends, you have exactly what you value and care about right now in the present. And that idea for me is one of the most philosophically and emotionally fruitful ones for trying to adjust the kind of project-driven orientation that I think was at the root of my midlife malaise.
We were talking to Kiran Satya, a professor of philosophy at MIT, who's written a book about midlife crisis, but with help from philosophers. It's called Midlife, a Philosophical Guide. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Tell us about whose words of wisdom have helped guide you through midlife or toward midlife if you're younger, or from midlife if you're older. Whether it came from Aristotle or a fortune cookie, share it with us here at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Email here from Deborah and Talent. She says, I think a midlife crisis is a construct of the privileged. People who are focused on subsistence don't get this self-indulgence. May we all get to have a midlife crisis. That Deborah and Talent.
I mean, I think that's a common concern, and I think there's definitely something to that. So if, for instance, the sense that I had all these options in youth, and now they've been narrowed down, that I have my career, I mean, that's a kind of luxury problem to have. The problem that you had all these options, and now you're pursuing successfully one of them. Good for you. I think many of the problems, though, are really not specific to people whose lives are people who are affluent or successful. So the sense that life is a sort of grind of necessity, the kind of anxiety that Mill had, that it was all about just solving problems, and there was nothing positively valuable in it. I mean, that's especially a problem for people whose lives are lived under duress. And I think problems like the sense of mistake and misfortune and coming to terms with those kinds of problems, the sense that projects and things need to be done and that you're not able to fully appreciate the present, those kinds of crises are ones that I think cut across wealth or affluence or privilege. They're really features of dealing with the fact that human life involves a certain kind of irreversibility of time, a kind of relentless temporal progression that we have to somehow adjust ourselves to. So I think the answer to that is sort of mixed. So there are problems that are luxury problems, and then there are problems that arise in midlife that are really quite pervasive parts of the human condition.
I guess I'm not surprised to find somehow in the section on John Stuart Mill, wisdom from a baseball player, although I would have thought it would have been Yogi Berra. It's Jackie Robinson instead. How did he get in here?
Well, I'm mean about Jackie Robinson in the book, even though I admire him very much. I mean, there's the quote on his gravestone that he says, life is not important except in the impact it has on other lives. And it's clear that there's something wise about this idea that it matters what difference your life makes to other people and that you should look outside yourself. The problem is that if you take that to be all that the only difference life can make, the only value your life can have, is the effects it has on other people's lives, then there's this sort of regress problem. There's this paradox that the effect on their lives doesn't really matter either, because the only value of their lives is the effect that they have on other people's lives. And so it looks like life's value is sort of endlessly deferred. And I think this is what I call in the book the paradox of altruism, that altruism is important and probably a neglected value. And yet there has to be some value in people's lives in themselves in order for altruism or helping other people or trying to make their lives better to make any sense. And this again connects with Mill, because there was a way in which Mill's life was devoted in an excessive way to altruism, involved a kind of focus on solving other people's problems and reducing suffering that actually obscured for him the value of his own life and the value of in his case, reading Wordsworth's poetry. So I think you can go too far in the direction of that kind of altruism.
Did John Stuart Mill ultimately end up happy after his quarter-life crisis, as you point out he had in his 20s?
You know, it's hard to know, because he seems like, by temperament, a fairly dour individual. I mean, one of the things that happened to him that's a really wonderful part of his story, a complicated part of his story, is that he fell in love with Harriet Taylor, who was a married woman. So they had to sort of defer their relationship for a long time until her husband died. But she was a sort of intellectual partner, and many of his most important books, for instance, The Subjection of Women, were in effect sort of co-authored with her. And I think that was a real source of happiness for Mill.
Much more to talk about with Kieran Satya. His book is called Midlife, A Philosophical Guide. We can take your phone calls and emails as part of the conversation when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about midlife crises and how we deal with them. And it's from a philosophical perspective, because we're talking to Kieran Satya, professor of philosophy at MIT. He's written a book called Midlife, A Philosophical Guide. We eschew the red sports car and take a bus ride with Immanuel Kant and Schopenhauer and Hegel and all the above, and all the way back to Plato and Aristotle. You can join us on the exchange. Your thoughts on midlife crisis and words of wisdom that might help you or have helped you, whether in a fortune cookie or from an ancient philosopher, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So two people thinking some fairly similar thoughts here. John in Ashland says, it seems this subject is often thought of as a male experience. Is there a difference in how women perceive this phase? That's an email. And here's Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, I think, with a similar concern. Hi, Wolfgang.
Hi there. Similar, yeah. Because if you go back to the ancient philosophers, they're male, and the attainment-oriented, redemption-oriented view of life, you know, the biblical, you're a sinner unless you are redeemed, puts you behind the, you're born behind the eight ball, and you spend the rest of your life trying to get the job, get the wife, get the kids, and the picket fence and all of that stuff. And that is an attainment linear setup where you are bound to fail. You can't win, you know, and then you're dead.
Ah, well, okay. Thanks for the thoughts on that, Wolfgang. Appreciate it. Dick Kieran?
Well, I think that's very interesting. I mean, I think the picture that Wolfgang was just describing of sort of ambition and aiming at attainment and achievement, the sense that that's bound to fail, is one that I felt also, and I share. And I think that that's where this distinction between telic and atelic activities comes into its own, because I think there is a way in which the pursuit of projects is sort of ultimately bound to be self-undermining or self-subversive. If that's all you care about, then every time you invest in one, you just finish it. And then the question is always, what's next? And so I think being able to value sort of the ongoing activities is really getting off that sort of train of ambition and future attainment, not valuing that exclusively, I think is really an important shift. And maybe that connects with gender also, and maybe explains why the midlife crisis has been historically more associated with men than women. But in fact, even if you look back in the 1970s, depictions of the midlife crisis, it's definitely gendered in this Gail Sheehy's book, Passages, Predictable Crises of Adult Life, which really sort of cemented the idea in the U.S. in 1976. she describes female midlife crises too. It's just that they take a different shape because they're often about the kids leaving home. At that point in the 70s, very, you know, relatively few women had college degrees or had the kind of careers that it's now somewhat easier for women to have. So I suspect that the gendering of the midlife crisis has become less distinct as feminism has made progress in allowing women to have the kind of careers that were once available only to men in places like the U.S. So I suspect that the contrast is less sharp than it used to be. In terms of the social science, when we look at the U-curve, that shows up as much in women as it does in men. So that there's no evidence there that it's particularly gendered.
All right, let's take another call here from Ed in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kieran Satya. His book is Midlife, A Philosophical Guide.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, I was an artist in New York for some time, and I wanted to mention that I think in terms of being an artist, I came to my midlife crisis at a certain point when I recognized that my art was not valued by the culture. And I also wanted to relay a little story that one time in my youth I was fortunate enough to go to the studio and meet Willem de Kooning, the great abstract painter. And I had heard that he kept a volume of Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations by his bedside through his whole life. And I asked him about that. And unfortunately, he was somewhat senile at the time, and he sort of brushed off my question and said it was a northern thing. But my understanding of Wittgenstein, which I find very difficult, was that I think he was looking for some kind of reassurance that his paintings actually appealed to other people. I wonder if you have any idea about that.
All right, thanks for that, Ed. Appreciate that. So Wittgenstein, did he show up in this book?
Actually, interestingly, Wittgenstein is not a major figure in the book, although he could have been, in that his philosophy famously comes in sort of two phases, this youthful explosion in the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, in which he claims, in relative youth, I guess he was probably in his late 20s, to have solved all the problems of philosophy. He then leaves philosophy and then comes back in a kind of second phase of creativity. So he had some kind of midlife shift. And interestingly, one of the striking things about the Elliot Jack essay in which the term is coined is that although he draws some examples from his clinical practice, most of Jacques' examples are drawn from creative artists and writers like Michelangelo or Goethe or Wordsworth. And what his main evidence for the midlife crisis is that artists in their sort of late 30s tend to either become creatively silent or to have some dramatic transformation in their creative style, kind of the way Wittgenstein did in his philosophy. So it's very interesting that that he sort of around midlife engaged in a kind of reassessment of his artistic practice, because that exactly fits the kind of stories that led Elliot Jack to posit the idea of the midlife crisis as a fundamental psychological phenomenon.
I noticed that. I didn't turn it into a question, but the age 37 thing for a number of creative people, and yet lots of other people like Goethe, you mentioned, who produced well into their lives and produced well.
Yeah, so there's a sort of, they fall into two categories for, the artists fall into two categories for Jacques. The ones who, like Wordsworth or Rossini, sort of stop their creative output after their youthful, relative youthful burst of creativity, and ones who pause and then are transformed in the way Goethe was or Michelangelo. So they're both sort of, the idea that there's a midlife crisis was all along conceived not just as something negative, but as a possible opportunity for rebirth or sort of reimagining one's life. And I think the 37 has probably shifted forward a bit, mm-hmm. as people tend to at least strive to maintain their youthfulness a little longer. I think the idea that you have a midlife crisis, 37 seems young now, although it seems about right to me. But I think a lot of people say, 40s or 50s is the paradigmatic midlife phase. So maybe the date has shifted somewhat, but But yeah, the basic idea was there from the beginning.
If I haven't made it clear yet, the book is by no means confined to just philosophers. And in fact, you tell us the story of Reginald Perrin, a character created by David Nobbs. Why is he in here?
This is a sitcom that I watched. I grew up in England, and there's a sitcom, The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin, which I loved. So this was already in my mind. But it's kind of basically the idea of the sitcom is this guy, Reggie Perrin, has a dreary commute to work at Sunshine Desserts. He has a meaningless job, and his marriage is sort of stale. And what he does is he fakes his own death and then leaves, pretends to be this new character, Martin Wellborn. But then he comes back, gets hired to the job that Reggie Perrin used to have, and then ends up marrying his old wife. And I think it's a very interesting kind of study in the way in which sometimes what's frustrating about midlife isn't necessarily the content of life. You may, even when you're doing things that you think are worth doing and want to be doing, the fact that you have to do them, I mean, the sheer fact that you don't have other options can make them seem less worthwhile than perhaps they are. And Reggie Perrin sort of dramatizes that contrast by basically re-inhabiting his old life, except now it's something he's chosen, not something that he can't escape. And I think trying to pull apart the two questions, like what do you want to be doing and how much is your frustration with your life just a frustration about the absence of options, and how much is it a frustration about the particular things you're doing, is a useful exercise in figuring out whether and how much it really makes sense to change your life at midlife. And sometimes it does. Sometimes the right thing to do is to leave a marriage or a job or a career or make changes. But I think it's possible to feel deeply frustrated, even when in fact the problem is more about your attitude or orientation to what you're doing than a need to actually change it.
And talk about regret. You include Simone de Beauvoir in here. She brings the house down with her book ending with the phrase, "I realize with stupor how much I have been swindled." Ouch. What did she mean by that?
Well, it's very puzzling what she means by it. So she's describing her life narrative. She's sort of summing it up at the end of an autobiography and saying, she's thinking back to her youthful dreams and saying, you know, they've all been realized. Everything I wanted and promised myself I would achieve as a teenage girl, I've done, and yet I feel swindled by it. And the book just ends there, leaving you sort of mystified by it. So there's actually an interview with her in the Paris Review a little later where she talks about what was bothering her. And I think in her case, it has to do with the sense of sort of the inexorable passage of time, the sense that no matter how well you achieve your ambitions, at a certain point, they're in the past, and now you're just looking back at them. And there's a way in which what she really wanted in her youth was to have these things, but also to have them sort of permanently or atemporally, or to step outside the passage of time, and that's not something that is possible. And so I think that there's a way in which regret or a sense of loss is inevitable that somehow she hadn't seen coming when she was anticipating her future life, and that now sort of occludes the rest of her past.
I guess I'm just struck by, you know, in my own life as well, obviously, by how differently we can view parts of our lives when we have achieved more of them. You know, when you get to you know, your late 50s, you realize you think very differently about the things that you thought about in your teens and 20s.
I think that's really interesting. I mean, one thing I think about in writing this book is what I would have made of it if I'd read it 20 years ago. Like, mm-hmm. if as it were, I could somehow, through time travel, would it have seemed to me sort of unrelatable because it would have been the writing of a middle-aged man to a excited 20-year-old who is into philosophy. And I have the same thought about whether I'm curious, and this time I will actually get to find out, whether when I'm 65, looking back at this book and reading it, whether I'll think, yeah, this was on track, or, you know, there was a whole lot about life I still did not know when I was in my mid-40s. I'm sure there's a lot about life I still don't know, but it is interesting to think about the trying to sort of come to terms with things in the middle. I mean, I think this is the in-the-middle predicament of midlife, is that you don't get to wait until you can see the whole thing and then form a final perspective. You have to sort of try to think it through on the fly as you're living it.
And I want to get Epicurus in here before we go, because he certainly put his stamp on some kind of a good life. I mean, what essential thoughts from old Epicurus can help us as we think about the middle of life?
Well, Epicurus, is sort of his main sort of claim to fame in this context is that he originates some of the principal arguments that are supposed to show that fear of death is irrational, so to help us come to terms philosophically with mortality. And so, for instance, he has the argument that he's a hedonist who thinks the only good thing in life is pleasure, the only bad thing is pain. And when you're dead, he says, he doesn't believe in a kind of afterlife of the spirit. He thinks death is the absolute end. He says, well, you won't feel any pain, so what's not to like? Why fear this? Unfortunately, I don't think that argument is really very convincing, because even if you don't feel any pain, you also don't feel any pleasure. So even if all you care about in life is pleasure and pain, because you're a hedonist like Epicurus, you might still think death is pretty terrible, because it's the end of all the pleasant things, the end of all the good things in life. So in the chapter on death is very much about the struggle to find philosophical therapies that really get to the root of the kind of deep existential angst about death. And I think there are therapies that are somewhat more effective than this Epicurean one. For instance, for me, it's helpful to think about the way in which immortality is like, I mean, not wanting not to die is in effect wanting to be immortal. And wanting to be immortal is kind of like wanting a superpower. I mean, it's sort of an incredible magical gift. And I think that there are therapies like that are somewhat helpful, but in the end, I think death is a very difficult thing to come to terms with.
Absolutely, as is midlife crisis as well, which is where we are at the moment. It's amazing how you managed to cram the work of this many philosophers into a relatively tidy, small book called Midlife, A Philosophical Guide. Kieran Satya has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author. Thanks so much for joining us today, Kieran.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.